Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening into the show today because we're delving into what happens in a courtroom when a police officer is on trial. What do the juries see and hear? What kind of authority and advantage does that police officer carry into the criminal justice system? Why are so few police officers indicted or convicted for excessive or deadly force? The rate of prosecution for deadly force is under 2%. Now, these are key considerations in the Derek Chauvin trial, which continues this week. And we've invited two guests to take your questions and mine. What do you want to know about why it's so difficult to prosecute and then convict a police officer for misconduct and other serious crimes? Do you think a police officer who is being prosecuted for excessive or deadly force is too often given the benefit of the doubt by jurors? Phil Stinson is with us, a professor in Bowling Green State University's criminal justice program and a former police officer. Professor Stinson, I'm really glad you could join the show today because I've used your database as a key source for the conversation. So welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, good to be with you, Carrie.
Alexis Hogue is with us, a lecturer at Columbia Law School, a former assistant federal public defender, and a civil rights attorney. Alexis, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie.
Sorry about that. I am sorry, Alexis. I don't know what was going on.
Good morning.
Good morning. Professor Stinson, I want to begin with some numbers that come straight out of the database that you have help compile at Bowling Green University. I found that no more than 125 officers across the country have been charged with manslaughter or murder nationwide when an officer has used deadly force. Is that correct?
Well, the number is just a little bit higher. I think the number, in terms of the shootings, it's 139 since 2005 to the current date. That's my count, and that's the closest that I have. And it's just an artifact of the way that we process our data. We're about 5 years behind in terms of most of the cases that we follow. You know, we follow police officers who are arrested for any crime, on duty or off duty, but we follow those cases for about 5 years before we fully code them and add them to our database. And as you mentioned, a lot of our data we've made publicly available through the Henry A. Wallace Police Crime Database, where you can search the data. But what we see is, you're right, when we add the non-shooting cases in, we still only have about 12 to 15 times each year an on-duty police officer is charged with murder or manslaughter as a result of a use of force incident where somebody was killed. And in those cases, we only see just under one-third of the time an officer, about 31% of the time, an officer is actually convicted in one of those cases. And more often than not, when an officer is convicted, it's for a lesser offense. It's not for the most serious offense charged.
Wow. A lot to pull apart there. Alexis, is the reason for the small fraction of prosecutions and convictions because of the way the laws are written, because of the hesitancy of prosecutors to take these cases to court? And we'll talk about why. What is the reason that there are so few of these prosecutions that go forward in incidences of deadly force?
Yes, Carrie, it's all of those reasons. There are inherent conflicts that arise when a prosecutor seeks to charge the very people, law enforcement officials, that prosecutors normally rely on to supply them evidence in other types of cases that they routinely prosecute. And then the law provides police officers broad latitude to carry out their duties, which can include use of force. And so there is this standard about a law enforcement official being able to use lethal force if they reasonably believe that their life or the life of a bystander is in danger. But that's from the law enforcement official's perspective. And it has to do with the circumstances of what's going on, the environment. And when a prosecutor tries to bring this type of charge before a grand jury, it's difficult. And I think that grand jurors, lay people, we have a tendency to believe police officers over civilians. So it becomes a credibility issue.
No, I was just going to say, I don't want to miss what you said at the beginning there about prosecutors mm-hmm. working with police officers and then having to be in an adversarial position. Will you draw that out a bit more, what we should understand about that relationship?
Sure. Law enforcement officials, police officers, are the ones that routinely supply evidence in routine cases, the bread and butter cases that prosecutors routinely prosecute. And they work hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder. They supply witness evidence through statements that police officers collect. They are essentially the investigators that work in tandem with prosecutors. And so they're all part of the same law enforcement consortium. And so now pivoting, when a police officer is now a suspect, a prosecutor has to create a case, build a case against someone they have been working with, an entity they have been working with. And that's why in the Chauvin trial, we see the state prosecutors taking on this case, not right. the local Hennepin County, because they want to create some distance between the individuals that routinely work together. And so they've asked the state then to carry out this prosecution, not the local Hennepin County prosecutor's office.
Let's take some calls to John in Minneapolis. John, I'm really glad you called. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Yeah, I hope I can make it very succinct. I do think that qualified immunity has given too much power to the police to make decisions, and then they're covered no matter whether it's the right decision or not to take another person's life. They have way too much power, I think, in this society to do that. And qualified immunity, I think, needs to go. The George Floyd Act, I think, needs to be passed. But also, I wanted to say, to get back to what police officers are supposed to do, when they first started forming police departments, like in Europe, London chose a path from Robert Peel, where, they're supposed to be peace officers that live in the community. They actually were like social workers. Mm-hmm. So this is nothing new in the history of police. And I think that, of course, they've gotten away from that and they have some of the same issues that we do. But in our law, we've given so much power for the police to protect themselves from prosecution for taking another person's life.
Okay, John,
and I think they need to be licensed.
Thank you, John. I think I have the essence of what you're saying. And Phil Stinson, if you'll weigh in on this idea that John's talking about of qualified immunity and how that influences prosecutorial decisions and what happens in courtrooms.
Well, qualified immunity comes into play when there's a federal lawsuit, a federal civil rights lawsuit, typically what we call a 1983 action against an officer for violating somebody's civil rights under the color of law. So if the officer is sued in their official capacity, that's considered a lawsuit against the employing municipality. And if they're in the individual capacity, lawsuit, then it's a lawsuit directly against the officer personally. But I do agree that we need to get rid of qualified immunity. However, it's important to consider that the reality is that most police officers are judgment proof. The purpose of getting around qualified immunity is to obtain a money judgment or a money settlement in a civil action. And most police officers simply don't have the deep pockets that plaintiff's attorneys, civil rights attorneys, are seeking to reach so that they can hopefully bring about change in that agency. So I think it's a complicated issue, but I think the reality of it, if you talk to civil rights attorneys, they would tell you that, they probably are judgment proof in many regards. Now, John mentioned a whole bunch of things there. He talked about Sir Robert Peel. That's 200 years ago. I take his point, though. It's a good point that many police officers now are not from and of and about the communities in which they police every day. They live in different places. Their children go to schools in different areas. They worship in different places than the people that they encounter on the job every day. And that's a big problem, because it's very easy when we send police officers out as warriors, that warriors need to have an enemy, and that's the people that they work with. We need to shift to a guardian mentality as opposed to a warrior mentality, to stop being fighting a war on crime or whatever the new war would be, that we're sending police officers out who work in quasi-military organizations, dressed in quasi-military uniforms. It's a problem. And he brought up the point John mentioned, you know, originally the idea was almost along the lines of social workers. Mm-hmm. So we do need to consider, what is it we want police officers to do? What is it we want policing to do? Because in many regards, policing is broken.
Alexis Hogue, to this question of being judgment-proof, Phil Stinson just said you talk with a civil rights attorney and you are one, and you pretty much acknowledge that this is right. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, John's comment, his call, there's so much to unpack there. And what I want to follow up on Professor Stenson's commentary is that a Section 1983 action is a private right of action, and it's something that an individual who has experienced the harm brings to a federal court. And it's directed not just against police officers, but it could be any state official acting in their capacity that then allegedly violates the rights of that person. And what's really unique about a Section 1983 lawsuit is that it actually derives from Reconstruction. And when we look at how the laws that we have today play out, I often return to history with my students. And we have to think about that period following the Civil War, when Black people, after emancipation, were being slaughtered, assaulted, raped, maimed with impunity. There was no pathway for recourse. And so Congress passed the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. That's where Section 1983 comes from, is that allowed an individual to go into federal court to seek redress and remedy for a violation of their constitutional rights by a state actor. Hmm. And what we have with qualified immunity is that it was judicially created in 1982, so about 40 years ago. And it has now, the way that it operates, become absolute immunity. And so often these lawsuits aren't just directed at the individual state actor, the police officer. They're also directed at the police department, sometimes also the police chiefs, often the municipal or local oversight. So it's the city, the city council, so whoever's overseeing the police department. And then each of these defendants ends up being able to assert, as an affirmative defense, qualified immunity. And so no one is held accountable. Courts are not looking at the merits of the constitutional violations that were raised. And there needs to be some sort of reform on qualified immunity so we can return to the very reason that we have Section 1983 as a means of redress.
Boy, that history is really valuable. I was completely unaware of that. Professor Stinson, I want to ask you something before we go back to the phones here. I was digging into the Washington Post database, where they're keeping track of the number of people who have been shot and killed by police in the last year. When I looked at it, this was probably, I don't know, 10 days ago, 988 people had been shot and killed in the last 365 days. Here's what's remarkable to me. The number has been consistent in the 6 years that they have been keeping the database. Now, I'm going to understand here that many of those deadly force incidents are justified, and that there's been an investigation, an internal investigation, and they have been found to be justified. But the other thing that you pull out of that is, for all of this awareness and scrutiny of deadly force, it looks like the police methods have not really changed that much. Is that a right interpretation of this?
Well, that's certainly my interpretation, and a lot of people think I'm very jaded when I say that. But when I look at the data from the Washington Post, and by the way, I helped them come up with the idea for that project to begin with back in late 2014 and early 2015. And the reason for that, the reason they were really interested in that and that they decided to keep going with it is because the Justice Department, the federal Justice Department, still does not do a good job of collecting data and counting these types of incidents. According to the data that we look at from the Justice Department and from the CDC, they would tell us that on-duty police officers shoot and kill people about 300 or 400 times a year. So we're seeing something completely different. And it's fascinating to me that it's fairly static, that we see the same numbers every year. By the way, going back to 2006 or so in my own research, where I collect data on officers across the country who are arrested for any crime, we see almost every year identical numbers, the same numbers. So there's something about the methodology that we're using that we're finding the consistent, you know, number of cases. We may not find every case, but we find a similar number of cases.
Okay.
And the laws of statistics seem to apply here.
Will you speak, though, to my larger question, which was, is it clear to you that when it comes to deadly force, police departments have not really changed their methods, even given all the awareness and scrutiny on this?
They haven't changed their methods, even in some places where the policies have changed and where there have been policies at the local level and legislated at the state level. And that's because we have more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. All policing is local. And the real issue here is the police subculture, the culture of policing. And even though all policing is local, there are some common features of the police subculture that are core values that exist at most of these agencies across the country. And until such time as the culture has changed, I really don't see we'll see changes
the
in terms of the numbers of people each year who were shot and killed, and various other types of police behaviors simply are not going to change. And that's a sad thing, but I agree with your point.
Let me remind listeners here, if you're just getting in on the show, Phil Stinson is with us, a professor at Bowling Green State University's Criminal Justice Program and a former police officer. Alexis Hoge is with us, a lecturer at Columbia Law School and a former assistant federal public defender and a civil rights attorney. And we've invited them to the show to really understand what happens when a police officer in really rare cases, this is what makes the Chauvin trial pretty rare, is on trial for a very serious charge. The kind of authority and credibility that is conferred on police officers in the criminal justice system, how jurors wrestle with that, why deadly force incidents, as we've just talked about, are not declining. Are police departments changing under this awareness and scrutiny? And I'd like to hear from you your questions about why it is difficult to prosecute and convict a police officer who has been charged with misconduct and more serious crimes. Do you think police officers who are being prosecuted are too often given the benefit of the doubt? Josh in Bloomington. Hi, Josh. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I was listening to everything y'all were saying, and it just seems like a paradox sometimes, because you're trusting everything, your safety, your life, to someone, and it's just like, well, I'm a member of the LGBTQ community, and during this whole thing, Trump was still in power saying blah, 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 you know, being irate. And you had a member of the police union, I forget the name, but just spouting off his rhetoric. So how am I, a member of the LGBTQ community, supposed to put my trust in life into those protecting, I'm supposed to protect, I'm paying tax dollars and all that stuff.
Yeah.
While a lot of my trans, black, brothers, sisters, non-conforming individuals are afraid, you know? This is a constant thing. This is nothing new, but, it just seems unprofessional when you're putting all these, you know what I mean? It's just a paradox.
Yeah, Josh, I do. I think paradox is a good word for this, Alexis Hoeg, because who's the first person, you know, especially, I guess, white communities are trained to call it's the police. It is this idea that we are conditioned to see police officers, and most of them do serve communities well as protectors. And then to flip that around and have to view them as something else is apparently pretty difficult for jurors. Give us your experience and your view on this.
Yeah, Josh raises some really good points, and I think it returns to Professor Stenson's earlier comment that there's really a police subculture. So there's the, you know, official duty and training that police officers are part of and engage in and train out their duty. And as you say, Terry, many officers do carry out their duty well to protect and to serve. And a duty of care, which is some of the language we're hearing out of the Chauvin trial. But then there's this undercurrent of a subculture. And as I did previously with my commentary, I do return to history here. And we think about how policing, law enforcement started in this country. I think about slave patrols and private agencies that were hired by industrial leaders in the late 19th century to break up labor organizing. And so when we think about policing in that way, that it was meant to monitor, control, and re-enslave Black people through slave patrols, and this is not just in the South, but in the North, to return Black people who had escaped slavery back into slavery. And then when you think about the Pinkertons, were this private agency that Andrew Carnegie hired to break up labor organizing. I don't know that we have moved that much further away from monitoring, controlling Black and brown people, and returning to subjugation poor people. And so when we think about the way that police officers serve and protect and what this subculture is, I cannot divorce it from that early period. And policing as an institution is not that old. I think the first municipal police department was in Boston in 1838. The federal law enforcement, derived, I think, also around that period. And so, we have this relatively young institution that still operates under that legacy. And so we have this perpetuation of sort of subjugating classes of people. Josh, the caller, identifies with the LGBT community. And who are law enforcement out there to serve and protect? And sometimes it's not those of us that are already from marginalized communities. So he raises some excellent points.
Kimberly says on Twitter, police unions have a significant impact on whether an officer is convicted. Since union leaders are elected, they're backed by interest groups and have large amounts of funding, making it easier for corrupt police to change precincts and avoid punishment. I think we have another question here about police unions to Linda in Minneapolis. Hi, Linda. Is that what you were thinking about?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening to a podcast recently about police contracts and how they mandate how their misconduct is investigated, interviews, you know, when they can have them, who can be there. So I'm just wondering about the impact of police contracts on this whole process.
Professor Stinson, can I come to you on that as a former police officer?
Sure. Well, not everywhere is there a collective bargaining in the public sector. What I look at in some of these instances where I've dealt with researched cases of police misconduct, police crime, a lot of times what happens is that the municipalities, the employing agencies, don't follow the collective bargaining agreement. They make some mistakes. They cut corners. And it's important to remember that police officers who are accused of misconduct are entitled to due process. And I think that in some respects, it's a little bit much to blame it on the unions. However, I do agree that in some places, the police unions are very powerful. But if I could just for a moment, I wanted to go back to a to a point Josh made in terms of policing and how police officers treat members of the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. A number of years ago, I was invited to participate in a Justice Department task force on gender, sexuality, and 21st century policing. And the reason they brought me in was to take a look at my data and see if we could come up with any data that's relevant to the charge that we were given. And what we found was that, among other things, members of the LGBT community are often treated very violently by police officers. The crimes by police officers are often very violent, especially as to transgender women. And it's a very troubling set of findings that we came up with.
Where does that come from, Professor Stinn? I mean, does it come from, buying into stereotypes, bias that an officer might go into an interaction with?
Well, some police officers, we're not talking about all, but some police officers treat people who are vulnerable members of the community or who they perceive to be vulnerable members. So people that police officers perceive to be sex workers, exotic dancers, strippers, variety of different types of sex workers. They treat them often in very violent ways. And when we look at the cases where officers are arrested for crimes against those people, they're often very violent and involve horrific levels of harassment and torture in some cases. So it seems that some police officers who are sexual predators view these people as throwaways, as people who, if they came forward to file a complaint, would not be believed by law enforcement authorities. And it's horrific. And again, this is a very small subset of police officers we're talking about. But Josh's points are very valid and very concerning.
Call here from Josh in Andover. Hi, Josh. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, I'll be quick. So first off, 2%, you said, are convicted. So maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that, instead of looking at it as like not many police officers are convicted of these crimes, maybe they're doing their job and they were in the right.
Mm-hmm.
Second off is you're talking about picking people apart by culture. Like police, I don't generally think that they look at this person. I mean, everybody profiles people. But do they look at the transgender community or the LGBT and go, oh, yeah, we're going to pick on them? Or is there a problem in that community? Same with, black and whatever. Why can't we look at this as a whole, as one culture, because there's many cultures in this country? Why can't we look at this and say, what do the police need to do in order to stop this stuff from happening, instead of making it a race issue?
Alexis Hogue, I let me put this, the first part of Josh's question, like this. Are the numbers low of prosecutions because the incidences are low? Is that what these numbers tell us?
Yeah, thank you, Terry. And I'd love to also hear some more of the numbers from Professor Stinson, but my understanding is that it's not necessarily because these incidents of misconduct are not happening. It's that the legal requirements and standards to bring an indictment, to secure a conviction, to get an actual sentence that involves incarceration, is quite difficult when the suspect is a police officer. And I think it very much has to do with the fact that society has a hard time viewing police officers as criminal suspects, given the context in which they normally operate. And we had an earlier caller ask about the civil lawsuit, Section 1983. There's a federal criminal equivalent. It's 18 U.S.C. 242. It also happens to derive directly from Reconstruction-era legislation, so the same overriding issues that I spoke about earlier in the hour. And with Section 242, it's a criminal federal statute that a federal prosecutor, so a assistant United States attorney, is filing against a police officer, so prosecuting them in the criminal context. And part of the problem with securing a conviction there is that it requires showing of specific intent, which is the highest of standards. to convict someone of a crime. And in this instance, a prosecutor has to show that a police officer actually knew that they were going to violate someone's constitutional rights, and that then they acted with that specific purpose in mind. And
that's a high bar. Yeah.
Very high, Terry. And it's akin to proving first-degree murder. And so it's not that these incidents of violence and misconduct and excessive force aren't happening. It's that we have higher legal standards in place for a police officer, for a state actor that's violating the constitutional rights of an individual.
Alexis Hoge, a lecturer at Columbia Law School and a civil rights attorney, and Phil Stinson, a professor at Bowling Green State University's criminal justice program. Professor Stinson, I'll remind our listeners here that our caller is asking, is the absence of prosecutions of police officers for serious crimes an indication that they're not occurring very often and things are as they should be?
Well, Josh's questions really get to whether it's a few bad apples or something else. The idea with the bad apples theory is that a police chief can publicly comment on an officer who's been disciplined or charged with a crime and say, this is a bad apple. Once we get rid of this bad apple, everything will be fine. And when you look at the data I've collected, and keep in mind, we've been collecting data since 2005. We have data on more than 18,000 cases of officers who've been arrested, about 15,000 officers during that time period. And we see the same types of crimes over and over again. The patterns are consistent from year to year. Now, as to the bigger issue, you know, when we look at these cases where an officer is charged and goes to trial and these crimes of on-duty violence, especially when somebody's been killed and an officer is on trial for murder or manslaughter, jurors are very reluctant to second guess what are often split second life or death decisions of on-duty police officers. They just aren't willing to convict, some or all jurors. And that's especially true when a defendant officer takes the witness stand in his or her own defense and testifies at trial, which, as Professor Hoge has alluded to and can elaborate on, it's a very, very risky thing for a defense lawyer, a criminal defense lawyer, to put their defendant, their client, on the stand because it subjects them to cross-examination. But what we see in these types of cases, even when there's damning video evidence, it's very unlikely to obtain a conviction. And then to the bigger question that Josh raised, we see the same pattern with grand jurors and grand juries across the country where prosecutors are seemingly having more difficulty in getting indictments and getting grand jurors to return a true bill. I've actually been contacted by prosecutors just in the last few months, in the last several years, across the country at various levels, who've been flabbergasted at their difficulties because typically a grand jury will indict when a prosecutor presents a case and wants an indictment. And we've seen great difficulties that prosecutors have had in even getting indictments. And they seemingly are surprised. And the prosecutors I've talked to that have called me, they're not new to this. These are journeyman prosecutors. These are career prosecutors who have a considerable experience and know what they're doing, and they simply can't obtain true bills.
Yeah, Professor Hoge, I think we then have to acknowledge, and I want this to be clear. You both have given us a lot of information about why. I want to say the answer is to Josh, it is not because it isn't occurring in larger numbers than we see. It is for a lot of the reasons these prosecutions are difficult and these charge filing, the indictments are difficult because of a lot of other factors in our criminal justice system. Can I say that?
Yes, Carrie, you can. Absolutely. And it also has to do with the fact that let's assume that, as Professor Stinson tells us, that a law enforcement official is successfully indicted. So after the prosecutor brings the case to a grand jury, they're indicted, and then we have a trial. I want to remind our listeners that many of these lethal force cases didn't even make it to that level. So I'm talking about Eric Garner's case, Sandra Bland, Stephen Clark, Michael Brown, Breonna Taylor, with the exception of endangering the bystander. But let's go into the next camp. Philando Castile, the officer responsible for his murder. Freddie Gray, the officer responsible for his murder. Both indicted. And so then we move on to the actual trial stage. And because of these larger structural forces, it is very hard for jurors to question the credibility of not just the law enforcement official who may testify on their own behalf, but their colleagues who testify. And then we have all of these secrecy laws that were passed generally through the lobbying of police unions at the state, you know, the local and state level, that helped pass state laws that remove from the public police officers, law enforcement, their personnel file. And so now when a prosecutor is building their case against a law enforcement official for misconduct, for excessive force, they can't get access to some of this information to help build this case. They can't. The individual who has been harmed can often not get access to the very information that would help them build their case. And it's only recently that we have started to give a hard look to some of these secrecy laws. New York just repealed 50A, which is the secrecy law here. California recently repealed the law enforcement personnel file secrecy law. And we're starting to see those be questioned and repealed at the local state level. But there are larger structural forces at play here, even assuming we're able to indict a law enforcement official. They're often then acquitted.
Call here from Josiah in Brooklyn Park. Hey, Josiah, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Glad you did.
No, that's okay. Thank you. I was just thinking about how minority groups, but in particular Black people, aren't taken seriously to begin with. When I think about Black women going to the hospital when they're pregnant and they talk about having problems, they aren't taken seriously and they're told to go home and they're being overdramatic and throw some ibuprofen at it or something. And I think that's their pain just isn't taken seriously. And I think a perfect example, unfortunately, is George Floyd, who was screaming that he can't breathe and that he was in pain. And that was invalid to Chauvin. And clearly, I mean, we look at that with just American institutions, that the opinions of Black people aren't valid, with students being suspended more, with people of color being arrested more, and with people dying more, the fatality of birth rates and mothers in the hospitals and stuff like that.
Yeah. Alexis Hogue, Josiah is talking to us in a larger sense here, I think, of a dehumanization in a number of the kinds of systems that make up American society. I'm sure you have something to add to that.
Josiah cuts at the heart of what we're seeing in the Derek Chauvin murder trial. And it's law enforcement society in general. I mean, he speaks about, you know, the medical context with Black women's experiences in hospitals. And this speaks to the fact that society assigns, presumes criminality and dangerousness with Black people. And this derives from slavery. And we actually had early American law or codes distinguished whether or not conduct was considered criminal depending on who the victim was. And crimes committed, acts committed against Black people, rape, murder, assault, those are not necessarily considered criminal violations. And our early laws, the only means of redress was often to an enslaved person's master for lost property, monetary sort of lost property or lost damaged property. And I'm speaking about, you know, an enslaved person. And so today, what we see with all this social science research is that Black people are seen not as
victims, our legal system sees victims and then Black people separately. I, as a federal public defender, I represented people who had been sentenced to death as I was working on their appeals. Mm-hmm. And what we see were higher rates of death-seeking, death convictions, death sentencing when the victim was white. That ends up being the driving force. And so we think about the worthiness of life and Black lives. Historically, in the criminal legal system and other systems, have been undervalued. We see Black people, our society sees Black people as having higher chronological ages for children. So beginning, you know, when Black children are in elementary preschool, there are eye-tracking studies that teachers are looking towards Black children to misbehave. They have higher rates of school suspension for subjective behavior. So acting out in class is no longer something that warrants a verbal reprimand, but rather a summons to the juvenile justice system. These were some of the cases I worked at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And it's pervasive. And we need a much larger reckoning in this society to help address this presumption of criminality and dangerousness with Black people.
Phil Stinson, I wanted to ask you something about, I'll bet you're aware of the Mohammed Noor case several years ago. Are you familiar with it?
Yes.
One of the things that Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman discovered when he led the prosecution of Officer Noor for the killing of Justine Ruschek was that other police officers, refused to give information to the prosecutors. And Freeman said this. I went back and watched some of the video of how he talked about it. He said, "I've never had police officers who weren't suspects refuse to do their duty and come forward to talk to us." Now, you've been a police officer. What is the understanding among officers that they will not sometimes cooperate in these prosecutions of one of their own?
Well, that's true, and I remember the press conference where Mr. Freeman talked about that and his frustrations and difficulties and trying to explain why it took so long to get an indictment. So in these types of cases, typically, the police own the narratives. Mm-hmm. In other words, what they write in their reports, the statements that the involved officers give to investigators, are really taken by other investigators, prosecutors, and the courts as the truth. They're accepted as what happened. What we've seen in recent years with the video evidence is that sometimes the statements made by police officers in those incidents are factually inconsistent with the video. We also see that sometimes the officers are acting outside the scope of their training. They're doing something completely different than what they were trained to do. And we used to think that a well-trained police officer would do exactly as they're trained to do. So speaking to Mr. Freeman's frustrations, if Professor Hogue or I went out and killed somebody today in a public place, the responding officer, which we're not going to do, but the responding officers would treat it in a certain way. They'd make a certain set of assumptions. They would assume it's a criminal homicide. They would secure the scene. They'd make certain notifications on the radio and on their phone to have other officials respond. They would canvass the neighborhood to get witness statements. They would collect evidence. They would write reports up in a certain way. And what Mr. Freeman found was that in these types of cases, and it was what happened in the Mohammed Noor case, that there were simply gaps. There were holes in the file that the prosecutor's office obtained from the police department, and it slowed down their work. They had to then go back and ask a lot of questions because what they were expecting to see in the case file literally wasn't there. That's something that, since Mr. Freeman made those comments, I've actually started to think about this and look and do some research in this area. And it's a phenomenon that's consistent with what we're seeing across the country.
As in, I mean, you know, we hear the kind of the blue code of silence, that kind of thing. This is real, that when one of their own is potentially under indictment or going to be prosecuted, it is understood that many of the officers will not cooperate. I guess I'm trying to figure out how common that is.
Well, it's one of those things. It's a hidden feature of police crime and police misconduct and police corruption. It's very difficult to measure that type of thing, but it's something that's been written about by scholars for literally more than 100 years, and, wow. and the research seems to show that, that does exist, and we certainly see that. We see that with prosecutors' frustration. The exception to that is when there are officers on the scene in these shooting cases where they were stunned that their colleague shot and killed somebody, and they immediately tell the responding investigators, "I saw everything, and I didn't think, I didn't perceive an imminent threat. I didn't perceive that threat." And that's important because it's the standard of objective reasonableness that the court would look at, whether a reasonable officer in that position without the benefit of hindsight. So the only place where I've really seen a breakaway from that blue coat of silence is in those limited circumstances where an officer is so stunned by a colleague's actions that they just, spontaneously utter and admit to the responding investigators, "I didn't perceive any such threat."
All right. Alexis Hogue, I have about 2 minutes. I'd love to hear you on that.
Yeah, well, in addition, Carrie, to the unofficial blue coat of silence, there are actually official factors that shield police from the very types of interrogations and investigations that are normally employed against run-of-the-mill suspects. And so in many jurisdictions, police officers have a special shield against certain types of questioning and interrogation. It's known as the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights.
Wow.
And this has been negotiated generally from police unions, and it protects police officers from these very tactics that are, really part and parcel of what law enforcement investigators use against civilian suspects. And so there are these unofficial methods and structural forces that help shield officers from liability and from carrying out an aggressive investigation as we would with any other civilian suspect. But there are also official things. And what I think is interesting about the Chauvin trial is that we have seen really a departure from some of these more unofficial tactics. So we actually have, at least the state has promised us, that we will hear from the police chief.
That's right.
About
That's
the right. type of training that Minneapolis Police Department officers go through. And it sounds like, from what the state has promised us at opening, that this is going to be testimony that is against Chauvin's defense. And this is highly unusual for many of the reasons that Professor Stinson has laid out.
Alexis Hogue, Phil Stinson, thank you so much for the time this morning. Really, really interesting conversation. I learned a lot. Phil Stinson, a professor at Bowling Green State University's Criminal Justice Program. Alexis Hogue, a lecturer at Columbia Law School and a civil rights attorney.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieMPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.